This is WFYI HD2 Indianapolis, The Point.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the cinemas and on DVD. Get ready for...
Wait for it!
Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Sozi!
No, that's Matthew Sozi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever. Yes.
Let's find out how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sozi.
Matthew Sozi. No, I'm sorry, that's a complete lie. I'm not Matthew Sozi. I'm Joe Scheer with the Film Yap. And with me today is my compadre, my compatriot, my hetero life mate, Christopher Lloyd.
Thanks for that introduction, I think.
And also joining the both of us is Richard Probst with the Independent Critic.
Good afternoon.
And today we have yet another week of movies to discuss. Matthew is on assignment once again. So today we're going to talk a little bit about Toy Story 3 and a lot of other movies.
Yes, I'm not sure if you know this, but Matthew actually leads a double life as a secret super agent man, sort of like Tom Cruise in the movie Night and Day, which is coming out next week, but which we saw yesterday. But okay, we're not exactly sure what he is. He's on assignment. We'll use a nice term. He's on assignment.
And he's not Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
But quite a busy movie week here in Indianapolis. I believe we've got about four new movies arriving in theaters and several more on DVD. So we want to just kick it off with our discussion of the big movie of the week?
I think so. We're going to start with, of course, the threequel of the greatest threequel in Pixar history, also the only threequel in Pixar history, Toy Story 3, starring, of course, Tom Hanks, Tim Allen, Joan Cusack, and a cast of thousands. So I think we might want to listen to a little bit of a trailer.
Red light mean it's going.
I've been cool. I've been hungry. Now for a while, I guess most of my dreams have come true. With it all.
Andy's going to college. Can you believe it?
Mom, I'm not leaving till Friday.
What are you going to do with these old toys?
Because I never knew. Losing you.
You get it? We're finished. Obsolete. Over the hill.
Now, come on, guys. We all knew this day was coming.
We're getting thrown away?
No, no one's getting thrown away.
We ain't ever getting played with.
Hold on. This is no time to be hysterical.
It's the perfect time to be hysterical.
Should we be hysterical?
Now.
Yes.
Maybe, but not right now.
Come on. Let's see how much we're going for on eBay.
New toys!
I'm gonna get played with!
My nose.
There it is.
Here's your arm.
Give me that. That's
honey,
mine.
The mustache.
We're busting out of here.
On three.
One.
Three.
Whoa.
To infinity.
And beyond.
To reset your Buzz Lightyear, insert paperclip.
Rex, use your finger.
Go. Did you fix Buzz?
Bitácora espacial.
Sort of.
Like
oh no.
Oh yes, we
return of the Astronaut.
All right, there you have it. Let's just get this out of the way. Is this the best movie of the year so far?
I'd say it's pretty close. I can't think of too many other movies that would be in the same range. I really, really like this movie. I mean, it is Pixar, and you know, they really do set their own standard, not just for animation, but for storytelling in general. As I like to say, you know, the absolute worst movie that Pixar ever made was merely very good. Mm-hmm. And usually, you know, they're excellent. I wouldn't put this near the top of the Pixar body of work, but I would say it's certainly towards the top. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I wouldn't put it as the best Toy Story movie either. I still think number two was actually very, very good.
Yeah, I agree.
But, boy, they really knocked one out of the park.
Really? No, see, for me, this was my favorite. Just emotionally, I connected to this story like I've never connected to Toy Story. I've always admired their, you know, their technology. I've always admired the stories, but this film, I mean, I was there, hook, line, and sinker the whole film. Mm-hmm. Shed a tear a couple of times.
Yeah.
Laughed quite often. Absolutely loved this film.
Yeah. The funny thing is, they got all the same beats in that they did in the other films, mm-hmm. but there was more. It felt like it was more grown up movie. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a few moments of real peril that the other two films didn't have, and it was actually pretty scary even at times. But you know, it was a much more grown up version, which was good, because it kind of gives the people who've grown along with the Toy Story films, it kind of gives them something to watch and be really truly entertained by and affected by. But it's still appropriate enough for little kids that it's not. You know, you're not scaring the crap out of them while they're watching this movie.
We should actually say this film is actually rated G. The first two Toy Stories were both rated PG, so this actually is considered more family friendly. Yeah. It is, in general, there's, you know, absolutely nothing resembling what I would call violence. Toys knocking into each other. Mm-hmm.
That phone was pretty battered.
The phone was pretty battered. There is that one scene. We're not going to describe it other than, you know, there's a moment of real peril involving, I think, almost all the toy characters.
Yeah.
And it's you know, forget about 3 or 4 year olds. You know, I got the heebie-jeebies watching it.
Yeah.
So just a little slight caution there. You know, if you have a very sensitive, very small child, mm-hmm. might want to prepare them for that scene a little bit. Of course, you know, the story here is about impermanence and growing old and, you know, finding that the role that you've always defined yourself with fading away and having to find something else to do with your life. Mm-hmm. So as I say, you know, like all of the best animated films, and certainly I would say all of the Toy Story films, or excuse me, all of the Pixar films, you know, it's a film that on the surface is meant to appeal to children, but really holds, I think, the greatest value for grown-ups.
Yeah, and I even saw it, you know, of course, as a married man and a father, I saw a lot of even parallels to marriage with the relationship between the toys and Andy, their owner. There's a lot of insecurity about them being dumped, more or less, by their, you know, by their owner and being kind of cast off into the world in a cruel way. And, of course, they find the kind of the main thrust of the plot is that they are donated to a daycare where the current residents of the daycare, including Lotso Huggin' Bear,
which is a real bear toy from the 80s,
and voice of Ned Beatty, and he promises them lots and lots of love from a multitude of kids, kind of the never-ending utopia for a toy, and they find they're thrown into the toddler room where they are beaten and abused and battered endlessly, and then they find themselves kind of prisoners. So it's almost a prison movie in as well as just an animated movie about toys. So
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is Sid in this?
Which one was Sid?
Sid was
the mean neighbor kid in the first one.
Yeah.
I think he makes a cameo, like you just see him somewhere. Mm-hmm. I don't remember seeing him, but I heard somewhere else someone said that he was like just in the background somewhere, or there's a reference to him or something.
You also mentioned that Andy is now 11, or no, Andy's not 11. Andy's going off to college.
Yeah. He's going off to college. Exactly.
So is like when you see Sid, is like Sid like getting out of juvie or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like I said, I don't remember seeing him, but I did hear there he makes a very brief little appearance.
Pixar loves to do that thing where they drop other characters into the backgrounds or hidden in the movies. Like for instance. if you go back and watch Up very closely, Lotso the Bear actually makes a brief appearance in that film.
Yeah, they all pretty much do that. There's, I believe Wall-E is in one of the earlier Pixar films as well. You can see him somewhere. They do say, I did read an article somewhere where they said that there's one of their Easter eggs in this case is a new character that's going to be in Cars 2. So that's, you know, that's the kind of thing Pixar does, is they just drop them in
that's
at
cool.
random.
Yeah. That is too cool.
Yeah, it's very cool, and it just adds to the experience. You know, you get all the regular storytelling stuff that you know, ordinary animated films, I guess you could say, do. But then you get just that much more, that much little more attention to detail, which makes it that much more of an enjoyable experience.
If you're wondering, interesting, I was interested in this, why it's been 11 years since Toy Story 2. Was it was not actually a matter of the Pixar folks not wanting to do a sequel. They wanted to do one right away, but you may remember that they had lots of fights with their parent company, Disney, for many, many years.
Yeah.
And they had signed this deal to do X number of films under the Disney logo, but the agreement stated that if they did any sequels, they would not count towards that tally. So it was one of these typical situations where, you know, lawyers trumped creativity, unfortunately. Yeah. But personally, for me, it was well worth the wait.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It continues to amaze me, though, that Pixar seems to be the only animated company out there that can do this.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what really blows me away, and they do it so consistently. It almost seems like they've created this wonderful blueprint of how to create the perfect animated film. And, you know, Hollywood loves to copy success.
Yeah.
Nobody can copy this magic.
Well, and the thing is, too, is they took a few risks in this movie. You know, they could have made Toy Story 3 take place a year or two after Toy Story 2, but they chose to do this really kind of milestone moment in Andy's life anyway, and it's a definite transition period for the toys. The toys are not, you know, being played with at the beginning of the film, and this is a whole new experience. And a lot of times in a sequel, when they just try to remake it, it kind of falls flat, but in this case, it really... It made the whole film blossom, and it even closed, again, without giving anything away, on a very emotional, very kind of a tender, fun, and even sad kind of moment, bittersweet kind of moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they forget about animated movies. I mean, I think Pixar is the best studio of any kind making movies today for storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's just the thing. It's something that struck me as... you know, we've been watching lots of movies lately preparing for the Indianapolis International Film Festival, which is upcoming. And something, you know, a criticism of some of the films that I had that, you know, also applies to more mainstream films is nowadays it seems like filmmakers, they write scenes. It's like, here's a great scene. We'll have this great acting, and there'll be this great exchange, and it'll be a great moment. But they don't write stories, you know, they don't have the arc, the continuation of, you know, things progressing naturally and logically and emotionally in a substantial way that makes sense, you know, both for the head and the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And Pixar just does that. You know, I'm frankly amazed. I mean, this is 15 years now that they've been at this, with Toy Story 1 coming out in 1995, essentially launching the evolution of CG animation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's almost, you know, critics have almost become like grim reapers and, you know, waiting for them to falter. Like, they've got to make a bad movie at some point, or at least, you know, just an okay movie.
And I really thought this might be it.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought three, that's pushing it, folks.
Yeah.
But
how many threes are really good, you know, especially, you know, over the past 8 or 9 years, there have not been, I don't know if any, they've been even good.
Yeah. Well, before we go out on this one, we would just like to mention that if you are interested in looking at a ranking of all the Pixar movies, you can go to thefilmyap.com, where Joe Shearer has a nice commentary where he sums up all of the Pixar films and ranks them from top to bottom.
Actually, our writer, Kane Gardner, wrote it. I did split it up into two parts for him, though.
Okay. All right. But anyway, so here's what we thought of Toy Story 3. All right, let's talk about IMAX movies now. Does that sound like a good idea? So we've got, just to do another quick plug for the Film Yep, our commentary on our podcast this week is about the evolution of IMAX movies, and a great chance to check it out for yourself is to go to the Indiana State Museum, which is today opening the new IMAX movie, The Ultimate Wave Tahiti 3D, starring 9-time world surfing champion Kelly Slater. Let's take a listen to that.
Thank you. There are 118 islands in French Polynesia, spread across the South Pacific. Many come to explore these islands of legendary beauty and warmth. Others come to play in the waves. There are waves for learning. And waves for fooling around. But the locals keep a careful eye on one of the world's most dangerous waves. A wave that only the foolhardy or the elite will tackle. Join 9-time world champion Kelly Slater and legendary Tahitian surfer Raymana van Bastelaar as they search for their own perfect wave on an island in paradise you will never forget.
Before we continue, let's make sure we make it known. This film is not at all related to Jaws 3D, right?
No.
All right. Just wanted to clear that up.
Although the notion of Michael Caine on a surfboard is really sort of appealing to me right now. I'd love to see that. Probably more appealing than that Harry Brown movie he came out with last week.
Oh, come on. Okay.
Septuagenarian surfer or Septuagenarian Dirty Harry? Which would you like to see? All right, well, so this is the new IMAX movie hitting, I believe, pretty much all the big IMAX theaters around the country today, and obviously the one here at Indiana State Museum. And as with these other sort of, you know, National Geographic type of documentary style IMAX movies, it is an absolute wonder to behold. You know, the visuals just absolutely blow you away. And, of course, if you're seeing it in that theater downtown, you know, with the however many stories high a screen that just absolutely envelops you. And this one is in 3D. And it was funny to me. Obviously, the surfing action is really great. You know, I think everyone who sees movies has seen all sorts of surfing movies and surfing documentaries. Yeah. But having it in the IMAX format with the 3D really does add something to it here.
Nice. I think it is safe to say the greatest surfing movie of all time is Point Break, right? Are we all in agreement on that? Maybe today.
How much actual surfing was in that?
there was a lot of Keanu Reeves falling off of a surfboard. I think Patrick Swayze did a little number, or his stunt double at least did a little bit of surfing.
Does that mean you didn't like From Justin to Kelly? Wow.
But I don't think it quite got to the greatest of all time status. I don't know.
It moved me. Okay.
But Kelly Slater is, we should point out, a Baywatch veteran.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Back when he was like 20 or 21 years old. Yeah.
Different Kelly, by the way.
Yeah. Yes, Kelly Slater was not in From Justin to Kelly.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I believe I'm the only one here who's seen this one. I would put this, it's a good, not great IMAX movie. It's about 45 minutes long, and they actually take until almost halfway through to get to the actual surfing footage. A lot of it is sort of like the history and narrative of the Tahitian people done in these sort of quirky...
History of the wave.
The history of the wave. Yeah, that's actually quite interesting stuff where they have these computer-assisted animations about how waves form and why certain special places like Tahiti, you know, bend those waves in such a way to make the really great surfer waves.
Wow.
Which, really interesting stuff. You know, like one of the statistics they threw out in the movie was that these waves off of Tahiti, the locals call it the demon wave. You do not want to fall off your surfboard here. People die on a regular basis there. The problem is because they have the corals that are, it's quite shallow. I mean, you know, they show underwater scenes, you know, where their feet are dangling off of the surfboard, and it's just a few feet further down to the actual coral reef. Wow. And you fall off of that, and they said 20 tons of water gets dumped on you.
Wow.
So not a fun time there. But, yeah, the surfing action is great. It does take a little too long for me with the the animated story about the Tahitian people. It gets a little, you know, about mysticism and their spiritual connection with the ocean. It gets a little hippy-dippy for me. Yeah. But the surfing action does come in right in and, you know, takes you straight through the end, and it is pretty amazing. Yeah. So here's what we have to say about The Ultimate Wave Tahiti 3D.
Now that was a good movie!
All right, we're about 20 after now on WFYI HD to the point, so probably a good time to take a break. So Joe Shearer, myself, Christopher Lloyd, and Richard Probst will be back in just a minute. And we're back here on the film sociology program with, once again, Matthew Soci is on assignment this week. Mm-hmm. Myself, Christopher Lloyd, and Joe Shearer from thefilmyap.com are here, along with Richard Probst from theindependentcritic.com.
Yes!
So, continuing our discussion of the week's new movies, we've got an interesting one now, Jonah Hex. It's kind of a...
Why are you being so kind? Interesting. What was interesting?
Well, it was interesting in the definitely
wow.
A very different movie.
Wow.
Well, it's a Western odor meets supernatural thriller about a cowboy with a burned up face who can speak with the dead. So it's like The Sixth Sense meets Fistful of Dollars and something.
This is not a spaghetti Western.
No.
I can't tell you. This is the second time I caught heat for not knowing what spaghetti Western is a couple weeks ago. Anyway, proceed.
Yeah. It is actually a superhero film also. Jonah Hex is based on a DC comic.
Yes. Actually, I think it's not a recent one. Actually, it goes back to the 70s, as I recall.
Okay.
But anyway, so here's a little preview, a little taste of Jonah Hex.
Don't do this, sir. Both, please.
Daddy!
Don't do this, no!
This mark will remind you of the man who took everything you had. After that night, some say he was a changed man. That his spirit crossed over, giving him powers that can't be explained.
Jonah Hex.
Love Coleman's. Thinking you might need a...
Cut him down!
Jonah Hex.
You don't look so tough.
Hey, Hex! What happened to your face?
Cut myself shaving. What happened to yours?
Always do like when you finally show up.
Jeez, woman, how many men you see in a day?
Quentin Turnbull.
Don't you dare say that name to me.
Quentin Turnbull surfaced about a month ago.
We want Turnbull dead. Why don't you just say that to begin with? Anything new, Smith?
Thought you'd never ask. But take it that means you approve. This is the future.
Future's bright. Can you shoot?
Can you?
This war begins right here! I own you now!
Not even much for being owned.
Turnbull!
We near settled our score.
What's it like to go through life with a face like that?
I show you. Still got that knife in your garter?
They took it.
Still got that derringer in your bustle?
They took it all, Jonah.
Well, searched you for darn good, didn't they?
Wouldn't you?
Alrighty, that's Jonah Hex.
That's now, as good as it gets.
I would like to take this opportunity to have a personal moment, if I may, and apologize to various readers of the Film Yap or for all our listeners in the Sarasota, Florida area who read my summer movie preview that I wrote for that newspaper and also for our website, where in which I actually identified Jonah Hex as one of the movies I was looking forward to this summer.
Wow.
What can I say? I saw an early preview that was all... It was all dark and mysterious, and it had most of it was John Malkovich and Josh Brolin there as Jonah Hex, and it looked really cool. And then I saw another preview that was actually much closer to the tone of this movie, which is jokey and lots of, you know, blowing guys away and then saying popping off a one-liner. And, well, Richard, I believe you've seen this one as well.
Yes.
Why don't you talk about it a bit?
If you're the kind of person who goes to a film because... You know, Megan Fox is in the film. You might find something to enjoy here, mainly looking at Megan Fox. If you actually require anything resembling a story or, say, something called acting or cohesion, perhaps.
Coherence.
Yes, exactly. No, then, you know, I mean, you were pointing out that this was made by the guys who gave us Gamer and...
The Crank movies.
The Crank movies.
Who billed themselves as Neville Dean Taylor. Neville Dean / Taylor, because we're too cool to use our first names.
That's, yeah. They just don't want to be known out in public. That's the truth. I mean, this...
And brought to you by the director of Horton Hears a Who.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, indeedy.
Wow.
It's really hard for me... Normally, it's hard to say what's wrong about a movie. In this case, it's harder to say what's right about this movie. It really just fails on pretty much all levels. It's not... I wouldn't call it a... Terrible movie, but it's just it's just not
good. I've seen worse.
I've definitely seen worse, but it's just not good. It's barely 80 minutes long, and even at that length, it feels kind of bloated, like it you know, was stringing out these scenes and just sort of carrying them along in nursing moments. The action scenes are literally incomprehensible. I mean, you know, you don't know who's where at what point and who's punching and shooting this way and that way. I mean, absolutely. No clue whatsoever. Even Jonah Hex's facial look is not good to me. Now, you know, story here, of course, is supposed to be that his mortal enemy, Quentin Turnbull, played by John Malkovich, captures him in revenge for turning in his men you know, takes a branding iron and sears it into his face, leaving him with this permanent mark. if you Google images from the comic book, or even just watch the actual animated bit of exposition there in the movie where they're describing, you know, what it looks like, they show him with this sort of, you know, very horrible look that sort of looks like the Darkman movie from 20 years ago. Which came out this week on Blu-ray, by the way, where you know where a large section of his cheek is removed and you can see his teeth inside. Well, it doesn't look like that. You know, this makeup job that they did on him, I guess they should have just gone with some CG instead. It just looks like they put some stuff on him and put like this incongruous strip of flesh kind of at the corner of his mouth. So like he's trying to chew on a piece of beef jerky all the time and it can't quite, he mumbles through the movie kind of talking like this. I think Josh Brolin did what he could with the part the way it was written, but it kind of ends up being a really sort of one note jokey role instead of really dark. And the movie's rated PG-13. I really was sort of kept wanting to amp it up and make it darker and bloodier. This movie is the sort of movie that deserved an R, I think.
I get the feeling it could have been a much better film than it is. Yeah. I mean, I really do. I think that the director did not rein in John Malkovich, who needs, as you pointed out off the air, who needs to be reined in. And Josh Brolin's, everybody here is better than they are in this film, except for Megan Fox.
Megan Fox and this movie deserve each other.
Exactly.
The thing you can say about the Megan Fox role, she plays this prostitute in town who's good with knives. And
is she acting?
Okay. And she and Jonah Hex have like this thing. He comes and pays her for sex, but they have an understanding.
Hex for sex?
Hex for sex.
Sorry. Okay.
Hex in the sex too. But I mean, there's no mention. I mean, you know, the character is supposed to be really gruesome, and of course she's gorgeous. I mean, and they don't even address the idea of, well, why a woman who looks that beautiful not be at all bothered by this absolutely horrible-looking guy. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't even address it. But more importantly, I mean, if you go through the movie, her character is completely unnecessary. I mean, it literally is just like, well, we got a lot of guy stuff here. You know, it's kind of, this movie's smelling like a locker room. Can we just put in a sexy chick for some reason?
Well, she was available.
After she self-bailed from Transformers 3.
Thank you very much.
Did I always say self-bailed? Is that quotations around the self?
She was bailed by Bay or Bay bailed or there was mutual bailing.
I thought that's how she got the job originally.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh. Yeah. A brief role by Tom Wopat from the Dukes of Hazzard as Slocum.
Nice. Oh, I forgot it. Ooh.
I did not even know that until I saw it.
The credit. Yeah.
But so once again, on a personal note, apologies to everyone out there who I, before seeing the movie, in my own defense, had recommended.
You are allowed to be wrong, Chris.
I'm allowed to be wrong, and boy, was I wrong.
Everybody gets one.
So here's what we thought about Jonah Hex.
Turn it off. Turn it off. Turn it off!
Okay, our next film is a little bit of a smaller scale film. It is playing, I believe it's only playing locally at Keystone Art Cinema.
I believe that's right.
Yeah, and it stars Catherine Keener and Amanda Peet and who's the man in the film? Oliver Platt.
Rebecca Hall.
Yeah,
Marissa Tomei.
It is called Please Give. So let's take a little listen.
I don't know if that place is as good as we think it is.
Wait a second. Excuse me, sir. Are you hungry? Would you like this?
I'm waiting for a table.
I'm sorry. So sorry.
Really?
Please forgive me.
You from a Salvation Army?
She's from a store on 10th Avenue.
I mean, it's probably junk.
What are we going to ask for that?
$5,000.
That's great. Where do you find your stuff?
We buy from the Children of Dead People.
How nice.
How's your grandmother?
She's great. She's doing really well.
They look at me like, is she dead yet?
You're a vulture.
Us buying that apartment has absolutely no downside. Her grandmother gets to live there. We're not hovering.
Hi, Andra.
You're gaining weight.
Excuse me?
You're gaining weight.
It's her birthday in a couple of days, and I thought we'd have her over for dinner.
You're joking.
You're a saint.
Make a wish.
Whoa.
You were flirting with his sister.
I have no idea why.
I am not spending $200 on a pair of jeans for my teenage daughter when there are 45 homeless people living in our
city. What does that have to do with anything? They don't want jeans.
She wants to save the world.
This is Kate. She might be volunteering here.
She's very bent over.
Of course, we keep it light. Always want to cheer them up.
Is it painful? It looks very painful.
That was his disease. I had no knees and I complained.
Hi.
No way.
Abby,
I'm keeping this $20.
Your guilt is warping you.
Why isn't it warping you?
Your guilt is warping me.
You've got a handsome boy then.
But he's very short.
And then I met a man.
How's that cake, Andra?
Dry.
And then I met a man.
Can't we just put a drill over her head?
And start construction?
Alrighty, and that's Please Give. That's written and directed by one of the few female auteurs out there. I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce her name right here, but I'm going to give it a whirl. Nicole Holofcener. I think that's how you pronounce it. We'll call her Nicole. but she's done quite a few movies with Catherine Keener. Walking and Talking, Friends with Money, Lovely and Amazing, which was a lovely and amazing movie a few years ago. So I believe I'm the only one that's seen this one. Is that right? So
yes.
I actually was a bit disappointed by it. If you're an indie movie person, and I think all of us in this room are, see that preview that we just listened to, and you say, "Wow, I want to see this movie." It just looks like it's really going to snap and pop, and the movie just kind of ends up lying there. The performances are uniformly wonderful, just wonderful. There's this very young actress named Sarah Steele who plays the daughter of Catherine Keener and all of her Black characters. She's been in a couple of things. Terrific, terrific young actress. Plays this really sort of nasty character. But, you know, still we like her and we forgive her because we understand she's supposed to be 15. And
I remember when she debuted in Spanglish thinking she had amazing potential.
Yeah, really, really terrific. Kind of a hard movie for me to – I just felt like I couldn't – it didn't invite me in. I felt like I was observing this ensemble cast of characters, but not really understanding them, not relating to them either in a positive or negative way. They were just sort of there, and I was watching them, and I felt the movie kind of pushed me away a little bit. The theme of the movie is kind of hard to grasp. I mean, to me, what it's about, it really is, to me, a criticism of the New York City mindset, in that all of the characters, with the exception of the Rebecca Hall character, are nasty people. Some of it keep it pretty close to the surface. Some people, like the Catherine Keener character, really keep it buried down. And, you know, to them, in their own mind's eye, they think they're nice people. Roger Ebert, in his review of this movie, referred to the Catherine Keener character as, you know, an innocent, a nice person. And I think he just totally misread the movie. Her character, you know, literally is more giving, you know, she's willing to be giving to strangers, but only with this note of being able to pity them. So, you know, she gives all this money to people on the street. At one point, if you saw in there, actually, you know, just stopping a regular guy who's waiting in line for a restaurant and gives him money. Do you guys have a take on this one?
So the basic plot is that Catherine Keener's character buys an apartment with is that correct? With the intention that their neighbor is an elderly woman who they are thinking is close to death. When she dies, they're going to swoop in, buy up her apartment and get themselves a...
Well, they've already bought it and I guess are renting it to her now. And the idea is that the deal is whenever the old woman dies, they will knock out the walls and make themselves a huge master suite.
Okay.
Which, if you're in New York, you know, where, you know, people literally kill themselves for an 800 square foot apartment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I remember when I saw the preview for it, I really thought it had a lot of promise, and it really I was really thinking that's one we need to go see. I need to take my wife to go see that. We'll have a good time at, you know, Keystone Art and you know, maybe have a drink or two. So it's a little disappointing to hear that it maybe wasn't quite what it could have been, because there's a lot of promise, and with that cast especially, there's a lot of potential to really make a great movie.
One of the things that excites me about this film, and I'll definitely still see it, is that Amanda Peet, you know, here is this actress who was kind of in line to be the next beautiful face, and she really went the serious actress route.
Yeah.
And she's been doing some great indie work, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't as well. But
she's really, you know, she's reaching for something different and, you know, staying true to her indie roots. And that's, you know, I mean, really, I mean, she's beautiful enough that if she wanted to be the next Julia Roberts, I think she could do it. But, yeah, I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm too down on this movie because, like I said, the acting is absolutely superb.
Mm-hmm.
Catherine Keener, you know, I mean, she's I think one of our best actresses in film today. And Oliver Platt, you know, he can sort of just reflexively do that, you know, oily character, but we still kind of like him. Yeah. He can just do that, you know, in his sleep. Rebecca Hall's great. And I'm forgetting the name of the character, the name of the actress who plays Andra, the old woman who's, you know, very nasty and has the old woman habit of just splurting out terrible racist things. Yeah, I just I don't have to say the movie sort of pushed me away and I was never really caught up by it as much as I was hoping to. Mm-hmm. But so here's what we felt about Please Give.
I think it's overrated.
Shut up, you!
All righty. Well, we're going to take another quick break and we'll be right back with the video store.
These any good?
I don't watch movies.
Well, have you heard anything about either one of them?
I find it's best to stay out of other people's affairs.
You know who I can do without? I can do without the people in the video store.
Which ones?
All of them.
What would you get for a 6-year-old boy who chronically wets his bed?
So do you have any new movies in?
Do you have that one with that guy who was in that movie that was out last year?
They never rent quality flicks. They always pick the most intellectually devoid movie on the racks.
Ooh, Navy SEALs!
It's like in order to join, they have to have an IQ less than their shoe size.
Just go open the video store.
Video store is open. And our first selection this week is a nice little bit of post-apocalyptic goodness with Denzel Washington, Mila Kunis, Gary Oldman, among others. It is called The Book of Eli, and let's take a quick listen.
They say the war tore a hole in the sky. Only a few survived. That was 30 winters ago. I have been walking ever since. Our only hope is in my hands. Some would kill to have it. I will kill to protect it.
Put that hand on me again. You won't get it back.
All right. Come on down the hard way.
Okay.
All righty. This one is from the Hughes brothers, Albert and Alan. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember if this was based on a comic book or not. I think it might have been.
I don't recall.
Actually, I think it's an original story.
I think it is.
As anything that can be, that's obviously a mashup. I remember in my review that I wrote, it's Mad Max meets, if you've ever played the Fallout video games, mm-hmm. with a little bit of Waterworld, except there's no water.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic looking movie. The technical expertise involved in this, they do this washed out, they wash all the colors out of the cinematography, so it's almost a black and white movie, mm-hmm. and it is a gorgeous looking movie.
Yeah.
And it does not have,
And
then the people show up. Does not have an intelligent bone in its body. Just the whole story there about Denzel Washington, Eli's walking across the country. I don't think we're giving anything away at this point that he's got the last Holy Bible on earth. And Gary Oldman, he's the smart guy running the town. He wants to have the Bible so that he can use it to whip all the people into religious fervor and then yoke them to his will. Well, here's my problem with that. One of the things movies love to do is they say, we've got a character who's super intelligent, she's super smart, and then we proceed to have them do obviously dumb things.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, if the Gary Oldman character is smart enough to know that he can use religion as a weapon, then he would be smart enough to know that you don't need a Holy Bible. You can just make up your own religion, write your own Holy Bible, tell people it's the Holy Bible. If there's none left, who's going to disagree with you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And do it that way.
Yeah. Ricky Gervais actually did that in The Invention of Lying with a pizza box. Wrote the Ten Commandments on a pizza box. So.
Wow.
But what did you guys think of this one?
I was underwhelmed. Like you said, it was very nice looking. It wasn't even a black and white movie. It was just a gray movie.
Yeah.
Which really worked tonally, the washed out colors. And like you said, the Fallout 3, at least video game, has the green tone where Book of Eli has gray.
Yeah.
So it works very well. But to me, it was, a lot of nonsense. And then Denzel Washington swings his machete really fast.
Yeah.
And then Gary Oldman chases after him. And then, and then it gets really silly. The whole last Holy Bible on Earth thing, seriously, there are how many millions and millions of Holy Bibles around? How do they know for sure this is the last one?
Does someone go into every hotel room and at every hotel in the world and pull the one out of the drawer there and destroy it? I mean, every single one. And it's never said.
Actually, yes, they did.
No. and it's never said why. Who destroyed all the Bibles? Yeah. Why? I mean, I like movies that sort of inhabit their own world where, they sort of leave the stuff in the corners to your own mm-hmm. imagination. But in this case, they've got stuff right in the middle of the story mm-hmm. that's just obviously like, oh, no, wait, that wouldn't be that way. And not to rag on anyone in particular, but Mila Kunis in this, this is a young actress who's found a knack for comedy. But boy,
not for drama.
She was, no. She was just this side of awful in it. I mean, she was really bad. Yeah. I almost felt bad for her because I've seen her be good in some comedic things.
Yeah. I think really the only semblance of saving grace were those few scenes where, Denzel and Gary Oldman are just sitting there talking and then Gary Oldman can go, completely wacko. And do what Gary Oldman does.
Yep.
You guys are nicer than me. I called it Battlefield Earth for Christians.
That's great.
And I do believe, Richard, you are a minister. You said you wish they would have burned that last Bible.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes, I did. And yes, I still mean it.
All right. Well, here's what we thought of Book of Eli.
Turn it off. Turn it off. Turn it off!
All right. Our next film stars Michael Cera. I believe that's the way we say his name. He starred in Juno. He starred in Superbad. And now he's starring in Youth in Revolt, where he gets to be the nerdy kid and the big badass guy. Let's take a listen.
This is Nick. I live with my charming mother. Her latest boyfriend, Jerry, is a pathological liar.
If a woman answered the phone, it was probably just a maid.
He's a real prize. My dad is currently in between jobs. Lacey is Dad's girlfriend.
Daisy, come near you.
It's amazing how much action everyone around me seems to be getting. With one exception.
Honey, this is Sheenie Saunders. She just stopped by to introduce herself. Isn't that neighborly?
For Nick, Sheenie was the one.
Do you mind applying this to my exposed areas?
Sure.
Until she became the one.
you get turned on easily?
Who got away?
Shinny, I think I love you.
Nick, you're very nice, but I have a boyfriend.
Hello, Nick.
Bad break, Nick.
Well, I'll be leaving. Shot to the
heart! Now, to win her over, he'll have to give love. Bad
night! I've decided to create a supplementary persona named Francois Dillinger. Bold, contemptuous of authority.
Thanks for breakfast.
Where are you going? And irresistible to women.
You're not gonna get this girl by sitting around listening to records.
It's time to rebel, Nick. It's time to be bad.
How far will one guy go for the girl of his dreams?
I burned down Berkeley for you.
So romantic, Nikki. Kiss me, you weenie.
I say we let the kid do the dishes. You and I retire to the master bedroom.
Mom, do you think it's a puppy love thing with Jerry, or is he someone that I can look forward to having around for years to come?
Sheenie's coming home for Thanksgiving. You should be there.
Paul served an appetizer earlier.
Stuffed mushrooms.
It's gonna change your life.
Have fun.
You're going to jail.
I'll only ask once that you and your adorable sweater step away from the door. Seems to me you've got two options. Fake your own death or commit suicide.
Nick, you're being so bad.
Not half as bad as the nasty things I want to do to you right now. If that's okay with you.
Okay, and Youth in Revolt. That's actually based on a series of books, I believe.
The Nick Twisp novels by C.D. Payne.
Yes, thank you very much. Interesting premise. Starts off with the Michael Cera doing the Michael Cera thing. and as we were commenting here offline, that you know he essentially plays the same role in all of his movies, mm-hmm. which, you know, you knocked that, but John Wayne did that for 40 years, and mm-hmm. it worked out well for him. Mm-hmm. Obviously, not a very John Wayne-ish persona in Michael Cera's case.
Eventually, he will have to stop being a teenager.
Yeah. Eventually. Eventually, he will have to be. You know, I really like the whole idea of the supplementary persona that he creates for himself to give him mm-hmm. the cojones to go do the things to get the girl that, you know, he would never do himself. Yeah. Richard?
I like that. There were things that about this film that drove me nuts. The animated transition scenes drove me bonkers.
Yeah.
I mean, occasionally, very occasionally, it'll work in a film. Here, it just felt like this freakish novelty that just didn't work at all. I thought we had a fun support cast. You know, you've got Jean Smart as his mom. Zach Galifianakis as his... Her boyfriend.
Zach Galifianakis is brilliant.
He plays his Michael Cera's mother's boyfriend.
Does Galifianakis do the typical Galifianakis thing?
No.
He's not.
He plays like a sort of a rednecky dummy.
Yeah.
I would say, which is
that's refreshing.
Which is like the absolute polar opposite of Zach Galifianakis.
Yeah. It worked for me. And Steve Buscemi is here and
ill used. I thought he was ill used. You know.
Yeah. But, you know, again, I think this is another case of we had a decent cast. The film could have been so much better than it is. And But I don't know. I mean, you've got a weak director. You've got this same guy who'd given us The Good Girl.
Yeah.
Who didn't know how to use Jennifer Aniston either. So,
yeah.
I don't know.
I thought it was... one of those movies, yeah. You see the hope for the future, but it never quite arrives.
Exactly. Portia Doubleday did have a nice debut in it.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on to.
Well, first, what did we think of Youth in Revolt?
I think it's overrated.
Shut up, you!
Our next film is one of an increasing number of starring roles for Kristen Bell, she of Veronica Mars fame on television. This is When in Rome, her romantic comedy she made with Josh Duhamel, as we discussed off the air, also known as Mr. Fergie. So what did you guys think of When in Rome?
I didn't see it.
You know, I thought it, you know, most of the critics trashed this film. I thought it worked. Josh Duhamel, I think, makes a great leading man. He has comic timing that I did not expect. Mm-hmm. He seems to have a gift for physical comedy. I thought some of the supporting cast again, you know, was stronger than I expect. You know, you have Danny DeVito. You have a woman who picks these coins out of a fountain, and the superstition in this town is that those men are then going to fall in love with her. So, you know, and the men who fall in love with her are Danny DeVito, Dax Shepard, Will Arnett, and John Heder. And they all play widely drawn, broad characters. You know, they go over the top, but they're all four good at doing that. So I thought it worked on a great level. And, you know, and Josh Duhamel is in there as the guy who might actually be sincere.
Mm-hmm.
And so she has to figure that out. For me, I gave it a slight recommendation. I gave it 2.5 stars. Okay. So I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. Kristen Bell, you know.
Do you guys, what do you guys think of Kristen Bell? My take on her is I don't think she's a movie star. I think she's a TV star.
Yeah. I think she's a TV star.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she was in Forgetting Sarah Marshall. She was probably the worst part of Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Playing a TV star.
Yeah, absolutely. Playing pretty much herself. I'm not that impressed with her, honestly.
Who could have been better than her in this film. Yeah. I like Duhamel, but...
Yeah. She just doesn't have that special something that, you know, a leading lady, especially in films like this, needs to have to carry the movie. You know, if you've got nothing else but, you know, the main character, you want something, you know, engaging and likable, and she's really, honestly, kind of dull and boring.
And I didn't know Will Arnett was in it. Will Arnett apparently is in everything.
He's great in everything, but someone
he's
said
the next Steve Buscemi.
Someone said it. He dooms most of his films to mediocrity for some reason.
Well, he was in Jonah Hex as playing a Civil War lieutenant, straight in totally non-comedic role. So he's an actor who, whenever he plays a role, you know, he gives it that weird sort of bend that makes it funny.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you just have him straight, you're like, well, why am I looking at this guy? If he's not being funny, I'm not really sure why I'm watching him.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, I think we're about out of time now.
What did we think of When in Rome?
What did we think?
It's overrated.
Shut up, you!
Yeah, now we're out of time. And as you can tell, Matthew Soucy is still not here. Maybe we would have been a little more smooth had he been here. But do we want to close on anything? Visit the Film Yap, www.thefilmyap.com. We have lots of free stuff to give away in the coming weeks. Lots of great things for you to read. You can comment. We have plenty of opportunities to make asses of ourselves.
And we exploit those opportunities.
Absolutely. We take liberties with those opportunities. So,
And also, don't forget to visit Richard Probst at
TheIndependentCritic.com.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, that's our show for this week. Matthew Soucy should be back next time. We thank him for letting us stand in.
Yes. Thank you, Matt.
All right. We'll take you out.
WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley.